Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's September 9th, 1971, and late morning at the Attica Correctional Facility in Western New York. Out in the prison yard, Richard X. Clark carries a heavy bundle of canned food as he heads to a table. Clark sets down the food and wipes the sweat from his forehead. His arms are sore and tired, but for Clark, it's a good feeling. As he looks around, he's struck by the transformation that's taken hold of this maximum security prison. Rival gang members are working side by side, carrying supplies to a medical tent. An inmate disinfects a wound on another inmate's left cheek. The prison yard has turned into a sprawling encampment, a democratic village that's run by the prisoners themselves. It's an incredible turn of events. For years, the inmates have been treated like animals. They were beaten mercilessly and never given proper food or medical care. But then, just a few hours ago, the inmates erupted in revolt. They drove back the guards, and after taking several dozen of them hostage, they took control of the prison. The prisoners then banded together and developed a list of changes they wanted to see in Attica. To reach these goals, the inmates elected a small group of representatives, including Richard X. Clark, a leader of the prison's black Muslim community. As Clark walks through the yard, he feels optimistic that the prison administrators will meet their demands. But Clark knows that, as basic as these demands may be, the upcoming negotiations are going to be tense. There's a high-pitched noise, and Clark turns, looking outside of the prison, where a man stands in a navy blue suit, holding a megaphone, side by side with several policemen.
Good morning. My name is Vincent Mancusi. I'm the superintendent of Attica. I'm here to talk with you. Now, whoever's in charge, please come over. Let's figure out a way to get past this.
Clark looks at several other inmates. All right, I'll talk with him. And if you want to come, you're free to join. The men nod. And wielding baseball bats and football helmets, they began making their way over to Mancusi. As they get closer, the superintendent holds up his hand.
All right, stop. That's far enough. Now, who am I talking to?
Good morning, Mr. Mancusi. You're talking to me. My name is Richard X. Clark.
Okay, Mr. Clark. Would you please tell your men to lay down their weapons?
I'm sorry, sir. I can't do that. We have to protect ourselves. But I promise you, no one intends any harm.
Okay, Mr. Clark. Have them stay there, and you can step forward.
I can do that.
Mr. Clark, Mr. Mancusi, as I said, no one intends any harm. Mr. Clark, I'd believe you if you were operating in good faith, but look over there. Those are my prison guards. They have bruises on their faces, cut up. They're scared out of their minds. Don't tell me about your intentions. Tell me what you want so we can put an end to this. Well, sir, it's simple. We need decent food and sanitation. You have to provide medical staff who are competent, and you have to replace the abusive guards. Clark pauses, staring at Mancusi. Maybe, sir, you should be writing this down. Oh, son, let's get one thing very clear. This is not a negotiation. I'm ordering you to let go of my guards. And why should we? Because until you let go of the hostages, I'm not going to even consider your demands. And if you don't let them go, I'll make damn sure you wish you had.
Before Clark can respond, his fellow inmates behind him lift their weapons and begin moving towards Mancusi. He grabs his bullhorn again.
Step back! Step back!
The policemen flanking Mancusi reach for their rifles.
Now, gentlemen, hold on now. Let's not do anything stupid.
Mr. Mancusi, we appreciate you coming down here, and we're committed to releasing the hostages, but only after we discuss our demands with someone higher up.
Higher up? Who do you want, son? President Nixon?
Nixon would be good, but we'll settle for the head of the state prisons, or the governor.
Are you out of your mind?
Sir, if you want your prison back, you need to send someone with real authority, someone who can make changes. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to make sure the hostages have been given a decent meal.
Clark turns away from Mancusi, and he starts walking back towards the prison. He feels proud of the stance he's just taken, and he knows he has the full support of his fellow inmates. Still, Clark is nervous. The prisoners are betting their fortunes on the goodwill of politicians, but there's no saying how other government leaders could respond or how dangerous the situation might grow. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. On September 9th, 1971, inmates at the Attica Correctional Facility led one of the most consequential prison uprisings in American history. It began as a chaotic melee, but within hours, the prisoners had taken control of Attica. Their top priority was to reform the prison, where conditions had been brutal for years. But they remained at odds with government officials, who sought the release of prison guards who'd been taken hostage. And in a show of force, New York State troopers were stationed outside the prison, ready to retake the facility if given the orders. But even in this tense atmosphere, negotiations inched forward. The inmates met with the head of New York's prison system, as well as a group of outside observers, and continued to push for changes at Attica. This is Episode 2, Amnesty. It's the early afternoon of September 9th, 1971. A black town car rumbles down a two-lane highway in western New York. As it makes a turn, a set of massive gray walls come into view. The car approaches the Attica Correctional Facility and comes to a stop. Russell Oswald steps out and gazes at the dizzying sight in front of him. There are at least 200 uniformed state troopers stationed outside the prison. Their faces are cold, with a feeling of war hovering in the air. Oswald wipes his brow and begins walking toward the prison. He knows this isn't safe. He's about to enter a high-pressure situation. People's lives are on the line. And if Oswald can't help resolve this crisis quickly, it could turn into a bloodbath, and he would bear the responsibility for it. Oswald is the head of the state prison system. And when he was appointed commissioner just a few months ago, he publicly vowed to reform New York's prisons. He believes strongly that inmates should be treated with compassion, that disputes like this one can be resolved with diplomacy, not force. But as he walks toward the entrance of the prison, surrounded by armed officers, Oswald can see that diplomacy will be a massive undertaking. Only minutes after exiting his car, Oswald reaches an office inside the prison. He steps inside, where he finds the superintendent, Vincent Mancusi, sitting slumped behind a desk. His face is pale and his shirt soaked with sweat. Oswald glances at a flask sitting on the edge of the desk. God, Vincent, you're not drinking right now.
Yeah, I am.
And so what? You've got to keep things together. Now's not the time.
Russell, now is exactly the time. If you were me, you'd be on your fourth drink already.
Oswald steps over to the window, where he stares out at Attica's yard.
Look at that. Men just walking free. Are those the guards? They're all huddled together.
What are those prisoners carrying? Metal pipes?
Yeah, and anything else they could find.
Russell, I'm telling you, it's scary. Never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
I'm scared too, but we're going to figure it out. What is there to figure out? It was good news when we took back these two cell blocks. But these animals, they got the rest of the prison. What are we supposed to do?
Oswald glances down at a group of prisoners who are handing each other medical supplies and plates of food. Then he turns from the window and takes a seat.
Well, Vincent, the first step is to stop thinking about them as animals. Oh, come on, it's just us. You can drop the act. It's not an act, it's earnest. There's a reason that these men revolted. All we do is punish. We need to start focusing on rehabilitation. So I think we should meet with them, figure out what they want, and if it's reasonable, let's meet their demands.
You're kidding me. They're violent. They've got weapons. Russell, I mean, you can't just reason with them.
Listen, I've got 250 state troopers. They're ready to move in. We can take care of the rioters in 10 minutes.
No, Vincent, you can't do that.
And why the hell not?
Because we're not resorting to violence unless we've exhausted every other option.
I need you to understand something. I am different than other commissioners. I'm not putting on an act, and I'm going to prove that my way works.
The superintendent scowls as he looks away.
I understand, all right. But you've got to understand something. If you want to do things your way, you're going to be the one out there.
And what are you talking about, Vincent?
The prisoners. They said they'd only negotiate with two people, you or the governor. The governor's not here. So I guess that means you're up to bat.
Oswald flinches. He knew he'd somehow be involved in the negotiations, but he didn't think he'd be on the front line. Still, as scared as he might be, Oswald also knows that this is the best way forward. Mancusi and the others are set in old ways. They view the prisoners as less than human, and that's not just wrong, it's counterproductive. So Oswald makes up his mind. He will go out into the yard and negotiate with the prisoners directly, but he's going to take a different approach than everyone else. He'll offer respect. He'll treat the inmates with dignity. And if all goes according to plan, he could prevent a deadly confrontation between the prisoners and police. Just after 1 p.m., Richard X. Clark bounds across the prison yard, his legs moving as fast as they can. On the other side of the yard, a group of inmates have formed a circle where they're shouting and raising their fists. Clark reaches the throng to find two inmates fighting. They're locked in each other's arms, throwing punches, grappling with each other. Spectators shout a mixture of fury and glee. Clark panics. The men can't fight with each other, not now. They're just on the verge of serious negotiations with the state government. They have to stay disciplined, unified, because if they don't, they won't be taken seriously and the negotiations will fall apart. Clark tries to push his way to the center of the circle to break up the fight, but he can't get through. The wall of bodies is too thick. Clark continues to struggle forward, trying to worm his way through the mass of sweaty inmates, but it's no use. Clark is about to begin shouting when suddenly something pierces through the perimeter of the circle, like a bowling ball crashing through pins. The other inmates go flying onto the ground. And then into the center of the circle steps a massive inmate who has dark brown skin and is wearing a skull cap. He's the size of an NFL lineman, and he yanks apart the fighting prisoners. He holds one prisoner by his forearm, and with his free hand, the man lifts the other inmate off the ground. Clark stares in amazement as everyone goes quiet. The towering inmate holds both men in his grasp and whispers to each of them. The two men remain glaring at each other, but then they each give each other a small nod. Seems they've reached an agreement. The large inmate lets them go, and the two men walk in opposite directions without saying another word. The crowd breaks apart, but Clark remains standing in place. He recognizes this large man. His name is Frank Smith, but everyone affectionately calls him Big Black. He's well known around the prison and well liked. And that gives Clark an idea. If this standoff is going to be successful, the inmates will have to maintain order. They'll have to stay civil and well-behaved. Otherwise, they'll never get their demands, and this whole uprising will have been for nothing. Clark knows that the men need a leader like Frank Smith, this strong and popular inmate. Clark approaches Smith and thanks him for breaking up the fight. Smith nods and starts to walk away, but Clark continues and tells him that he has a request. Would Smith take on a leadership role? He could run a security team, making sure that throughout the standoff, everything remains peaceful and safe. Smith shakes his head, saying all he wants is to lay low and stay out of trouble. He's no leader,
and he doesn't pay attention to politics or any of that. Clark nods and says he understands the hesitation, but no one can afford to be disengaged right now. Whether he likes it or not, at this point, they're all caught up in something far bigger than themselves. Staying neutral, lying low, that's not an option. And the prisoners desperately need someone like Smith to keep them safe. Smith pulls off his skull cap and runs a hand over his shaved head. He spends a minute thinking. Clark can see him processing the gravity of the decision. Finally, Smith looks up and gives a short nod. He says he'll do it. He'll run the security team. Clark pats him on the shoulder and says that's the right move. Together, he and their fellow inmates are building a true democratic society. They're organized and fighting for their rights. And after so much chaos, keeping the peace will be no small order. But if they're successful, they won't just get the prison to meet their demands. They'll show the world that they're worthy of being treated like human beings. 3 hours later, Russell Oswald steps over broken glass as he makes his way down a long tunnel inside Attica. He pauses to take stock of the site. This is where the uprising began, and several of the brick walls are stained with blood. As the head of New York's prisons, the sight is chilling for Oswald. He's sure that his partners feel the same way. Beside him is Arthur Eve, a black state legislator who supports prisoner rights. On Oswald's other side is Herman Schwartz, a white attorney who's close with several of Attica's inmates. Schwartz represented these men after they rebelled in another state prison. Oswald is glad to have these men by his side. Working together, Oswald hopes they can curry favor with the prisoners, showing that the two sides have a common goal. A few minutes later, Oswald and the men reach the entrance to the prison yard. He takes a deep breath and nods to a state trooper. Then they go in. The gate opens slowly, and waiting on the other side is a very large, very muscular inmate. He introduces himself as Frank Smith and says he's the head of security. They need to follow him to the negotiating table. Oswald pauses. They're about to enter a yard that's completely run by inmates incarcerated at a maximum security prison. Anything could happen. The inmate, Smith, sees the look of fear on Oswald's face and says he promises he won't let anything happen to them. The prisoners are peaceful and organized. Oswald knows he can't back out now, so he and his fellow negotiators step forward into the yard. As they walk, Oswald tightens up, spotting the hundreds of inmates who are staring at them. Nearby, he notices the prison guards being held hostage. They're sitting blindfolded on mattresses. Some look bruised and scraped. It's a frightening sight, but Oswald feels a sliver of relief when he notices the food and water sitting next to the hostages. And the longer he looks, the more he notices that they don't appear to have been mistreated. That's a good sign. Soon, Oswald and his partners reach a long row of wooden tables. An inmate steps forward and introduces himself with a calm voice. His name is Richard X. Clark. He's a leader of the prison's Black Muslims. He does not believe in violence, and he hopes that together they can reach a peaceful outcome, one that improves the lives of prisoners inside Attica. Oswald smiles. He finally feels at ease. He tells Clark that he shares the same goals. He wants to reform prisons and improve conditions for the inmates. But Clark suddenly frowns. The inmate says that if that's Oswald's goal, why in the world didn't he visit Attica last week? He made a promise, and when he broke it, he left the prisoners bitter and disappointed and ready to revolt. Oswald stammers out an apology, saying that the scheduling just didn't work out. But the nearby inmates chuckle, and Oswald can see they're not persuaded. So he decides to redirect the conversation. He tells the prisoners that he'd like to meet their demands, but in return, the hostages have to be released. Clark shakes his head. He says that first, the state needs to meet their most pressing demands. They need to know what happened to the prisoners Leroy Dewar and Ray Lamori, the two men who were dragged out of their cells after an incident on the yard. On top of that, the prisoners need food and water. They want the media to be allowed inside the prison. And they want a team of activists to come in and observe the negotiations as a neutral third party. But most important, Clark says, the prisoners who revolted need a legally binding promise from the state. They have to get complete amnesty for the uprising, and a guarantee they won't face any reprisals. Oswald knows that these requests will be tough to meet, but at this point he has to keep the negotiations moving forward. So he tells Clark that he'll do everything he can to meet the demands by 7 a.m. tomorrow. If he does, he expects the hostages to be released. Clark nods, saying they'll talk again tomorrow at 7. So for now, the discussions are over. Oswald thanks Clark for his time, then he and his partners turn and walk back across the yard. As he heads towards the exit, Oswald feels hopeful. He knows that this was a good start. The two sides are communicating with each other. The negotiations are respectful and transparent. Still deep down, Oswald has a nagging anxiety. He does want to help the prisoners and to work to reform Attica. But Oswald's colleagues in the state government don't share these views. They see the inmates as less than human, and they believe in punishment above all else. Somehow, Oswald is going to have to convince government officials to change their minds, to view the prisoners sympathetically, even after a bloody uprising. It won't be easy, and Oswald doesn't have much time. But it's the only viable option if they want to prevent a disaster. American Scandal is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm an introvert when there's not a microphone in front of me. People drain me. Even the smallest interactions, like ordering a pizza or calling a plumber, are taxing. And I know I avoid socializing sometimes because it's just so tiresome. But it's also delightful, a connection I crave, and that's a conundrum I'm still working on. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And as the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless search for a therapist. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/AS today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/AS.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's September 10th, 1971, around 3 a.m. It's a quiet night when a car comes racing down the main street of Manchester, a small town in southern Vermont. Herman Schwartz lays his foot on the pedal, the engine roaring as his hands grow white from gripping the steering wheel. Schwartz is an attorney, and he likes to think of himself as a law-abiding citizen. But tonight, there's too much at stake to follow the rules and drive the speed limit. Earlier today, he stepped inside the Attica Correctional Facility alongside a state legislator and the head of New York State's prisons. Together, they met with the inmates who'd overtaken Attica and begun a tense standoff that could turn bloody. According to one of the inmates' leaders, the prisoners' highest priority is to gain amnesty. They want to make sure that they don't face any reprisal for their actions, and they won't release the hostages until they get that assurance. It was there, standing in the prison yard, that Schwartz grew convinced he could help. As an attorney, Schwartz knows that Attica falls under the jurisdiction of a federal judge named John Curtin. If Schwartz could convince the judge to offer amnesty to the inmates, he could deliver on their central demand and help bring the standoff to a close. So Schwartz typed up a legal document detailing the terms of the amnesty. All he needed was the judge's signature. But when he called Curtin's office, his secretary said the judge was on vacation in Vermont. Schwartz didn't hesitate. He hung up and drove straight to the nearest airport. He hopped a midnight flight, and now his rental car comes to a halt in front of the hotel where the judge is staying. Schwartz jumps out of the car and dashes past the uniformed valet. He calls out that he'll be right back. Schwartz stalks down a hallway, and soon he finds Judge Curtin's suite and bangs on the door. There's no answer, but it is the middle of the night, and the judge is probably asleep. So Schwartz tries again. Finally, he hears footsteps padding over. The door swings open cautiously. Standing in the doorway is the 50-year-old judge, eyes barely open and a dumbfounded look on his face. The judge peers at Schwartz and demands to know what the hell he's doing here in the middle of the night. Schwartz begins to explain, but Judge Curtin interrupts him, says he'll deal with this tomorrow, then he shuts the door. But Schwartz stops it from closing with his hand. He says he's sorry, but this can't wait. What might be the largest prison riot in American history just took place yesterday morning. There's a good chance the inmates will face off against state troopers if they don't surrender. Lives are hanging in the balance, and their surrender hinges on the inmates receiving amnesty. Schwartz holds up the document he prepared and tells Curtin that all he needs is his signature. It'll help put an end to the whole ordeal. The judge sighs, then grabs the document from Schwartz. He retreats back to his room, and then a few minutes later returns with the paper. When Schwartz sees the judge's signature at the bottom, he grins and starts thanking Curtin over and over. But Curtin just rubs his eyes and groans, and then slams the door shut. Schwartz is proud. As an attorney, he spends his days fighting for prisoners' rights, and this may go down as one of the highlights of his entire career. But he can't dwell on it. There's more to do. Schwartz sprints out of the hotel, jumps in his car, and drives back to the airport. It's time to get back to Attica. It's September 10th, 1971, in Attica, New York, day two of the standoff. And just like yesterday, Russell Oswald is walking through Attica's A tunnel, heading toward the prison yard. Oswald is the head of New York's prisons, and once again he's joined by Arthur Eve, a state legislator, and Herman Schwartz, an attorney. Oswald rubs his eyes as he nears the yard. He didn't sleep much last night. There's too much to take care of. He and Eve had to put together a team of neutral observers, just as the inmates requested. And while the rest of the East Coast was asleep, Herman Schwartz flew to Vermont and returned with a signed court order promising the inmates would remain free from any legal or physical retribution. So even though he's tired, Oswald feels optimistic as he reaches the prison yard. He doesn't want to get too far ahead of himself, but looking at everything they've accomplished since yesterday, they may be close to solving the crisis at Attica. By tonight, the hostages could be back with their families. But as Oswald steps back into the yard, he notices that the inmates all seem grim. They glare at him, muttering angrily. He doesn't know what's wrong, but whatever it is, he's sure their moods will improve as soon as he tells them the good news. Oswald reaches the negotiation table and pulls out a chair across from Richard X. Clark, the inmate who's become a leader of the uprising. Like the other inmates, Clark looks furious about something.
Mr. Oswald, can I trust you?
Trust me? Of course you can. Why do you ask?
Because some of the brothers here are saying that I shouldn't.
I'm starting to believe them. You said you'd be here at 7 o'clock. You're 4 hours late.
Mr. Clark, I apologize, but these things take time. But look, we've made a lot of progress. We've got you observers, and I've checked on Dewar and Lamori, the two inmates. I saw them myself, and I promise they're fine. Additional food and water should be arriving within the hour. That's a start. But what about amnesty? We need protection after this whole thing ends.
Oswald turns to Schwartz, the attorney.
Herman?
Schwartz reaches into his pocket and pulls out the court order. Then he hands it to Clark, who reads it side by side with a group of inmates. A minute later, Clark looks up with a scowl.
This is worthless. I'm sorry, what do you mean? You have full amnesty. It's signed by a federal judge.
Man, don't play games with me. You got this signed, but where's the seal?
Our guy says that if it's from a judge, it's got to have a seal. Otherwise, it's not official.
Look, I'm telling you, it doesn't get any more official than this.
And that's not the only thing, man. Whoever wrote this, it says we get amnesty for what happened yesterday. What if something happens today or tomorrow? We're going to hold this prison for as long as it takes. So when we say we want complete amnesty, we mean complete amnesty.
The other inmates begin shouting, pointing at Oswald. They begin to come closer as if they're going to take him hostage. Oswald's body goes weak as the inmates approach him.
Look, men, hold on. Mr. Clark, please stop them.
Brothers, cool it.
Look, we do things democratically, so let's take a vote. I'm not in favor of it, but who wants to take Mr. Oswald hostage?
A few inmates raise their hands,
and who does not.
As more hands go up, Oswald feels a wave of relief wash over him.
All right, that's the vote. Mr. Oswald, you're still free. But we asked for observers, and I don't see them. So go on, get those observers out here. We're not doing any more talking without them.
Oswald looks out at the faces of the inmates and nods. Then he turns, and alongside his fellow negotiators, he heads out of the yard and back into the tunnel. As Oswald walks to the exit, he notices that his hands are shaking. He was moments away from being taken hostage by inmates in a maximum security prison. And now that he's walking away as a free man, he knows that he can never set foot in that yard again. But Oswald isn't ready to give up on the inmates. While he may have lost their trust, he still has a plan, a way to fix this damaged situation. Later that afternoon, Russell Oswald looks out over a room of faces inside an office at the Attica Correctional Facility. A motley crew has assembled for this meeting. There are a couple of prison activists sitting in suits and ties, a pair of young organizers in berets, a group of liberal newspaper columnists, and even a conservative state legislator. But sitting directly in front of Oswald is a man with brown, wavy hair who might be the most famous person here. His name is Herman Badillo. He's not only the first U.S. congressman who was born in Puerto Rico, but he's also a champion of civil rights. As Oswald gazes at Badillo and the other faces in the room, he feels a trickle of hope. This group could be the key to a peaceful resolution, but first, he needs to get them on board with his plan. Oswald stands and begins explaining the important task now in front of them. Yesterday, the prisoners overtook Attica. They've made a series of demands in an effort to improve life inside the prison. The list includes a demand for neutral, third-party observers who will watch the negotiations and make sure the prisoners are getting a fair shake. Everyone in this room has agreed to be one of these observers. Oswald pauses as the people in the audience nod their heads. So far, so good. Oswald continues, saying that while this was the original plan, the situation has changed. He needs every person in the room to be okay with a different role. Oswald explains that the inmates have grown hostile and negotiations have stalled. They're not going anywhere if the prisoners don't have faith in the process, but that's where the observers fit in. The inmates see them as allies. This means the observers could help reestablish a sense of trust that's key for the negotiations. But for the observers, that means taking on a larger risk. They can't just serve as passive onlookers. They need to actually take part in the negotiations and move the ball forward. Oswald pauses as the people in the room start to murmur. One of the activists stands up and points out that this is a heavy burden, and it's not why they came here. They're not trained negotiators. They were just supposed to watch the negotiations and make sure that they were fair. Oswald nods and admits it's true, but he assumes that every observer cares about the inmates. And if they do, then this is the best way to bring about resolution. The prisoners need to negotiate with people they trust. Herman Badillo, the celebrated congressman, stands up, his face set with a look of determination. He announces to the room that Oswald is right. The situation may be volatile, but there's still a peaceful path forward. Trust is everything, and without it, it doesn't matter who's acting as an observer. The negotiations will remain stalled, and eventually, the prisoners will suffer the consequences. All of those in the room can't let that happen. The other observers start to murmur. Then, one by one, they call out, announcing their decision. They agree this is the best path forward. They'll act as observers and negotiators. Oswald smiles with satisfaction. Then he picks up the phone and calls the guards. It's time for the observers to head out into the yard to meet the prisoners. It's time to bring this long standoff to a close.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the evening of September 10th, 1971, at the Attica Correctional Facility in Western New York. Attorney William Kunstler walks through a dimly lit tunnel inside the maximum security prison. He's flanked by guards with large rifles and dark circles under their eyes. Trailing behind him is a group of some 30 people. The group murmurs anxiously as they make their way to the prison yard and get ready to meet with the inmates. Kunstler knows why everyone is nervous. When they arrived at Attica, this group believed they were just here to act as neutral observers. But now they're about to negotiate with the inmates themselves, a group of men running on little sleep and who are aware that at any minute, the government could storm in and take the prison by force. The media has also assembled in the prison yard. And with TV cameras rolling, the whole world can now watch the events unfold at Attica. It's a combustible situation. But as the group steps out into the yard and Kunstler sees hundreds of prisoners walking free, he couldn't be happier. This is exactly the kind of work he loves to do. Kunstler is a famed civil rights attorney. He's represented Martin Luther King Jr. and worked with the Freedom Riders. He made national headlines when he defended the Chicago Seven, a group of activists charged with conspiring to incite a riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Kunstler admits that he feels a glow when he's in the national spotlight. But that's not what really drives him. His life's mission is to defend people who are oppressed and despised. And while Kunstler is a successful attorney, he's not satisfied to spend his days filing briefs and memos. He gets in on the action, which is why he's so glad to be at Attica with a larger role to play. Looking out at the yard, he can see it on the inmates' faces. They're weary and afraid. The prisoners' eyes dart left and right as they clench makeshift weapons like baseball bats and pipes. They look like they're about to snap, but Kunstler will do whatever he can to set them at ease and help them achieve their demands. Soon, Kunstler reaches the negotiating table. After introducing himself to the inmates' leaders, he turns to address the larger group of prisoners. As he does, the yard goes quiet. The inmates stop what they're doing and look up at Kunstler. Kunstler takes a deep breath. In a situation like this, first impressions are everything. He has to show the inmates that he's on their side. So he calls out to the yard, saying that New York has an immoral, decrepit prison system. No man should be treated with such brutality. They're human beings, not animals. They deserve dignity and justice. There's a small moment of silence, and then the inmates break out into cheers and applause. Kunstler smiles. He has their support. So he continues, promising that the observers are on their side. They're here to help the prisoners develop their final list of demands. And they'll join the fight, making sure that no matter what, the demands will be met. The cheering and applause grow louder. And out in the crowd, one prisoner calls out that he has an idea. What if Kunstler serves as their lawyer? Kunstler doesn't blink an eye. He tells the group that he'll take the job. He'd be glad to represent the inmates to help improve the conditions at Attica. The inmates break out into another wave of cheers and applause. And Kunstler smiles as he locks eyes with the prisoners. He feels he's earned their trust. It's an important first step. But from here, the hard work really begins. Kunstler and the other observers will have to juggle the interests of multiple parties, the prisoners, the state government, and the prison administration. And with the observers now taking part in the negotiations, they'll have to stay unified themselves. Otherwise, talks will once again fall apart. About an hour later, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller sets down a memo inside his office in Albany, New York. He rubs his temples, his eyes glassy, as he stares at the endless spread of reports and documents all about Attica. As governor of New York, Rockefeller has been flooded with information about Attica, but he knows that the situation really boils down to just one thing. The most dangerous men in his state have taken control of a prison, a building that was designed to contain them. It's an unacceptable problem, and no one in Rockefeller's administration has come up with a good solution. And that is raising an even bigger issue. Rockefeller has larger political ambitions. Maybe one day he could be a cabinet member or even president of the United States. But the entire nation has its eyes on Attica and on Rockefeller. He's presiding over a state where criminals have run amok. Every major American newspaper is running the story, and every time there's a description of an inmate walking free inside Attica's yard, Rockefeller looks weak and powerless. At the same time, he can't just order a fierce crackdown. The press would have a field day with that, and the political blowback would be immense. Rockefeller is stuck, unsure how to end this crisis. There's a knock on the door, and Rockefeller looks up to find New York Assemblyman James Emery. Emery has dark, severe eyes, and he's known for being tough on crime. That's why Rockefeller lobbied to make him one of the observers at Attica. He needed someone on the inside he could trust. Emery steps forward from the doorway and nods.
Governor Rockefeller, we need to talk.
Of course. I'm glad you're here. Have a seat.
Sir, I just came from Attica, and I have some troubling news.
Well, James, be straight with me. I need to know what's happening on the ground.
Well, what's happening is that the observers are all radical lefties. As bad as it gets.
I was afraid of that.
Sir, we can't trust them.
And the inmates, they were out of control.
Really?
I've gotten different reports. According to my aides, the inmates are behaving quite well.
I don't believe everything you hear.
Rockefeller looks away, considering these details. He knows that Emery might be embellishing the truth. He's known to be a hardliner. At the same time, the assemblyman was just in Attica, meeting with the prisoners.
All right, James, what else?
Well, you've got a big problem with that attorney, William Kunstler.
Bleeding heart.
He's a civil rights champion and basically told the prisoners he'd help burn Attica to the ground. He and the other observers are just egging them on. Things are going to get very violent, very fast.
You can't dawdle. It's time to use force.
Oh. That's concerning, but look, I have to find a way to solve this peacefully. Otherwise, I'm dead in the water.
Emery shakes his head.
Governor Rockefeller, I say this knowing that I'm the assemblyman and you're the governor, but listen to me. You have only one option, and that's brute force. You need to exercise that option right now. If you keep waiting, you're going to look ineffective. You can always apologize if you go too far. Voters, they might respond to that, but they'll never forget a loser. Someone who gets pushed around.
Rockefeller scowls, a bitter taste seeping into his mouth.
James, you're right. All right. But for now, I'm going to take a middle ground. I'm going to give the process at least a few more days. If the inmates don't surrender, I'll take action. We'll send in the troops.
Well, Governor Rockefeller, it's the right decision.
After Emery leaves the office, Rockefeller walks over to a window where he looks out at the state capitol. As a Rockefeller, he's been born into success, but still he's done well for himself, rising to be governor of New York. But his career isn't going to end in Albany. He's not going to let that happen. Rockefeller will try to end this standoff peacefully, to look presidential like a master diplomat. But if the situation descends into chaos, he'll play that other presidential role, commander-in-chief. And he won't hesitate to overwhelm Attica with force. Next on American Scandal, with tensions rising inside the prison and in Albany, an unexpected death upends the negotiations at Attica. And as both sides dig in their heels, the hope for a peaceful resolution begins to fade. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of the Attica Prison Uprising for American Scandal. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about the Attica Prison Uprising, we recommend the book Blood in the Water by Heather Ann Thompson. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz, edited by Christina Malzberger. Our senior producer is Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.